The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
Hello, everybody. Good morning. My name is David Noggle, and I am from Dallas Baptist University, local. One of the probably few that are. But in any case, thank you for coming to today's presentation. Our topic is Reordered Loves, the Key to Paideia in Education. That is our topic. But let me tell you a couple of stories about three buildings in a town. First of all, the town hall, then the hardware store, and then a church. The town hall brought in some cats to get rid of some squirrels. But after the cats tore up the files in the town hall, the mayor got rid of the cats. Guess what? The squirrels were back. The hardware store humanely trapped the squirrels, set them free on the edge of town, but 3 days later, guess what? The squirrels were back. So only the church had the right idea. They preached the gospel, they baptized the squirrels, they made them members, and now they only show up on Christmas and Easter. I am a college professor, and I would like to share with you a little limerick that tells the truth about college professors. There once was a man named Gesser, whose knowledge grew lesser and lesser. It grew so small, he knew nothing at all. And now he's a college. That's the truth about college professors right there. A former student of mine picked me up at the airport in Phoenix, Arizona. He was very kind. He went around the other side of the car to get behind the wheel to drive me to my location where I was to speak. And he felt the need to confess. He said, "I really wasn't much of a student when I was in your classes. And I had to tacitly, quietly, to myself, agree with him. He wasn't much of a student." But he said this: "I was in a group that taught me how to love God and to love other people." All this kind of reminds me, actually, of a line from C.S. Lewis in The Abolition of Man. He quotes Aristotle. He said that, C.S. Lewis said that, in quoting Aristotle, that education should teach us what to like and what to dislike. I think this student learned what to like. So I have a true-false question for you, and you can just answer quietly to yourself, no show of hands or anything like that. Was this student a great failure or not? This one who said he learned how to love God and to love people. He was formed, but he didn't study well. He was a C student, I guess you might say. He could still be president. And most of you are probably familiar with the fact that George W. Bush was a C student. He lives in the Dallas area, and he gave the commencement address at SMU not too long ago. And he said, and then he congratulated those who had done well, who were in the honors program and so forth. And he said, and if you are a C student, you could be president too. This student of mine was a C student. He wasn't very good. But his loves were properly formed while he was in school, at least on the way to being properly formed, while he was in school. So a true false question. Was a student a failure? He learned how to love God, or at least was on the way to learning to love God and to love people according to the first and the second greatest commandments. Was he on the way? He was on the way to having his loves properly formed. He had had enough exposure to truth for his loves to be rightly ordered. And that's really what I want to talk to you about today. The formation, and that's Roman numeral number one. I'm going to do my best with this technology. You know how that is. We want to talk about sainthood, but through scholarship. I think that this student, I would say, kind of half and half, sicut non, yes and no. I'm glad that his loves were properly, or on the way to being properly formed, but I think he probably could have done better. And so we want students to be formed through truth, which is what's on the overhead projector there. Formation through truth. The order of the loves. The ordo amoris. That's what genuine sainthood is. He was on the way, but he wasn't quite there yet. On the way to having his loves properly formed, I don't think he was a failure per se, but he could have probably done better. So Roman numeral number two is sainthood, which is having your loves properly ordered, but through truth, through scholarship, through teaching, through imparting to students a knowledge of what is true, of what is what, the objective reference. I have a couple of assumptions, or one assumption basically, I'm going to tell you about. And that is that I think that we have to decide what we are. And I think that we are lovers. We are of affection and desires. We are made in the image and likeness of God. No surprise there. But God is love. And if we're made in the image and likeness of a God who is love, then we are lovers, primarily. I think that we have to understand our own nature. We are of affection and desires. We want to know the biblical story. It begins with creation, obviously. Genesis chapters 1 and 2. We had a great fall. Humpty Dumpty. Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall. That's us. Humpty Dumpty had a great fall. You know that Humpty Dumpty ends in despair. All the king's horses and all the king's men could not put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Good night. But the biblical story doesn't end with the fall in Genesis chapter 3. But I think that Genesis chapter 3 and the biblical story does explain a lot of the difficulty, all of the difficulty that we face as human beings. I think students need to know the biblical story. What is the Bible? The Bible, for the most part, is the story of redemption. The offspring or seed of the woman will conquer serpent Satan. And that story is told largely in the Old Testament, and especially in the New Testament. In the Old Testament, Israel. In the New Testament, Jesus and the church. We need to know the biblical story. That's not a misprint. Already, but not yet. Redemption is already, but not yet. I think it was Oscar Kuhlman who said that we ought to compare the two stages of redemption to a present and to a future. By using this illustration, he said in his book, Christ and Time, that there is a D-Day. We've arrived at Normandy. There has been a conquest. But at the same time, there is also a coming victory, a final victory, a V-Day. And so he compared the already and not yet to V-Day and to D-Day and to V-Day. Ta Ponta, the cosmic Christ of Colossians. We typically think of Jesus as the Redeemer, but he's also the Creator as well. And, excuse me just a moment. Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 through 21 tell the story. And he, being Jesus, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For in him, and this is Jesus' role as creator, for in him all things were created, both in heaven and on earth, the visible and the invisible. Whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things, ta panta, have been created through him and for him. He is the object of creation. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. This is Colossians chapter 1, verse 17, where it says that he is before all things, and in him all things, sometimes the versions say, consist. This is the New American Standard, so it says, all, in him all things hold together. He is also the head of the body, the church, and he is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, so that he himself might come to have first place in everything. For it was the Father's good pleasure for all the fullness, and we can add, if we want, the fullness of deity to dwell bodily in him. And through him to reconcile all things, ta panta, to reconcile all things to himself, having made peace through the blood of his cross. Through him, I say, whether things on earth or things in heaven. And if we add ourselves in the mix, verse 21 and following, and though you were formerly alienated and hostile and engaged in evil deeds, yet he has now reconciled you in his fleshly body through death, in order to present you before him holy and blameless and beyond reproach. So that is the cosmic Christ of Colossians. He's not just simply our Redeemer. He is also the Creator of all things. And that, I think, is important for our people, for our students to know, that Christ is more than just simply the Redeemer. He is also the Creator, and he is the firstborn from the dead. In him, all things consist. Now, here's a little memory device. Checkmark and the Nike swoosh. You can probably remember that. I think those are good symbols of the biblical story. Creation, fall, redemption, checkmark. Or the Nike swoosh, which has to do with creation, fall, and a two-stage redemption as well. So if you can remember a check mark, if you can remember the Nike swoosh, then you've got the biblical story down very well. Can we enjoy our lives and be saints at the same time, too? There are a couple of books. First of all, Michael Whitmer's book. And I'm going to read to you a section of the foreword, just so you'll know what the book is about. Hang on just a second while I get it. Before I actually tell you a little bit about Michael Whitmer's book, which has that title, Can We Be Saints? It says Becoming Worldly Saints is actually the title. I do not know if it's for sale out there or not. But I learned what he had to say through this book by Alexander Schmemann, For the Life of the World, Sacraments and Orthodoxy. It says it's written for students primarily. It was published in 1963, though there have been multiple reprints of this book. And in the first chapter especially, he talks about the creation, fall, redemption story, but from the vantage point of Russian or Eastern and Eastern Orthodoxy. And he says in this chapter that we know God by knowing his creation. And I think that that's important as well. Can we enjoy our lives, the good gifts of God's creation, and be saints with loves properly ordered at the very same time? This is the foreword by Trevin Wax. Faithful Christian living involves a paradox. Our faith is both world-affirming and world-denying. World-affirming in that we believe that the world's structures are fundamentally good. We need to teach our students that. A part of God's very good creation, now longing to be restored. World-denying in that we believe that the world's systems are pervasively evil, firmly opposed to God and his loving rule and awaiting his judgment. Miss the goodness of the world structurally, Trevin Wax says, and you start to think the physical creation is bad. So God must be going to do away with all things in the end. He doesn't use the phrase ta panta. The Christian mission becomes getting people to heaven only, since the world is going to the other place. We all know what he means by that. It's the badness of the world systemically, and you start to think that sin is not as serious as we've made it out to be. So tinkering around with things in pursuit of improvement is all that is needed. The Christian mission becomes make the world a better place. Sure, there's more to it than just simply that. Careful Christian thinking holds these two truths, the world affirmation truth and the world denying truth, these two truths in paradox, never allowing one truth to drown out the other, never allowing the extreme position of the one side to lead us to the other. To miss one side of this paradox or the other is to distort the beauty of Christianity. And speaking of this book, he says, the book you are about to read pushes even deeper, reminding us that the world-affirming and world-denying Christianity are two sides of the same coin. We won't deny what needs denying unless we affirm at the same time what needs affirming. So it seems to me that he is trying to hold creation, fall, and redemption together in this book as a whole, and certainly the foreword expresses that, at the very same time, without any change. So it's paideia, it's formation. Another book, this one by Joe Rigdon. The foreword in this case is by a fellow that you're probably familiar with, John Piper. Here's what John Piper writes in the foreword to this book. Joe Rigdon writes as a persuaded Christian hedonist, that is, with the pervasive conviction that God is most glorified in us, famous Piper phrase, when we are most satisfied in him. But like all good students, he is not merely swallowing the teachings of Christian hedonism whole. He is digesting them so that they turn into energies and insight beyond his teachers, beyond John Piper's. And the fact that he, Joe Rigney, asked me, John Piper, to write this forward, and that I, John Piper, agreed to do it, is a sign that those insights are not contradictory, but complementary to the teacher's efforts. Joe has discerned that a strength of Christian hedonism can also be, at the same time, turned into a weakness. The strength is that Christian hedonism, as I have tried to develop it, as I, John Piper, have tried to develop it, has, as the Bible itself does, a strong ascetic tendency. For example, I often have these words, this is John Piper again, God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him, especially in those times when we embrace suffering for his sake with joy. Joy in affliction is a clearer witness that we treasure Christ more than comfort. And enjoy in comfortable, sunny days. That's John Piper. The weakness of this emphasis, and I continue on here with John Piper, the weaknesses of this emphasis is that little space is devoted to magnifying Christ in the right enjoyment of creation and culture. Little emphasis is given to Paul's words that God created foods to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. For everything created by God is good, and nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving. Or, in the words of Paul, that God provides richly all things for us to enjoy. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17. The first reference is 1 Timothy chapter 4. And John Piper continues, he says, the trees of biblical wisdom in regard to savoring God in the savoring of his creation and culture are not fully grown in what I have written in Christian about Christian hedonism. I sowed some seeds, but I never circled back to tend to those saplings, let alone grow them into a book. That's what Joe Rigney, the author of this book, has done. And I am so pleased with what he has written that I feel no need to write that book. It needed to be written, says John Piper, and Joe has done it. This book has been very helpful to me. This is John Piper speaking. I mean that personally. I think I will be a better father, husband, and friend, and leader because of it. My prayer for this book, and I'm skipping, by the way, through aspects of the foreword, my prayer for this book is the same as Joe's. May the Father of lights, who knows how to give good gifts to his children, teach you the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need, being brought low or being raised up. May he grant you grace to do all things, receive all good things, lose all good things, and endure all hard things through Christ who gives strength. Amen. Signed, John Piper. The title of the book is, I don't know if you can see it or not, but it is The Things of Earth, Treasuring God by Enjoying His Gifts, something that Alexander Schmemann said in his book that I had read earlier. Guess what? I wrote a book too. It's called Reordered Love, Reordered Lives. It has to do, it was published by Erdmann's. It has to do with the formation of virtue and genuine happiness in God by teaching truth. So I'd like to read just to share with you a little bit about what I have actually said in this book. What do you love? How do you love the things that you love? What do you expect to receive from the things that you love? There aren't too many questions that are more important than these. Why? Because as we love in our hearts, the Ordo Amoris, so are we. We reap what we love. Indeed, wherever we go and whatever we do, it is our loves that move us and take us there. That's a quote from St. Augustine. Especially in our pursuit of happiness. Now, the order of this book that I wrote on the order of the loves follows the biblical story of creation, fall, and redemption. There are some other things, too, that I want you to know about as well. First, my discussion of the deep meaning of happiness. And we might just be, because we have God, a little happier than we think we are. It follows the biblical narrative of a biblical worldview in terms of creation, fall, and redemption. The deep meaning of happiness as God intended at creation, rooted in rightly ordered loves and lives. But our genuine happiness was lost as we fell into sin, and it's replaced with a devastating ignorance and with idolatry. With disordered loves and disordered lives. The deep meaning of happiness already redeemed and one day fully restored in Jesus Christ, who graciously, Christ does, reorders our loves and our lives through the gospel in this present life. This grand narrative of Scripture is enormously helpful in elucidating Paideia. What ought to be, what things have become, and what things can and one day will be. Second of all, the view of Paideia and happiness that I have presented here is significantly countercultural. It's not an intense hedonistic pursuit. Rather, it is the condition of genuine human fulfillment and flourishing, rooted in a relationship with God, whose mercy and grace demonstrated in Jesus Christ reorders our loves and our lives. That's Paideia through education. Reorders our loves and our lives in righteous and in virtuous ways so that we are able to enjoy, indeed to relish all aspects of life and creation appropriately in Him. And the third thing that I emphasize in this book is that the content of this book is a contemporary expression of the grand tradition of Christian, not secular, but Christian humanism. Christianity, in my estimation, and I'm sure yours as well, is the true humanism, since it provides the only adequate basis for affirming the value and dignity of human beings who are made, and then we are remade, as the image and likeness of God. There's also virtue that comes about as a result of the proper forming of our loves. There is a reordered life of virtue, intellectual virtue. I'm skipping over a lot here. Moral virtue. And physical virtue as well. There's body care. There's creation care. There's culture care. And there is also animal care as well. All those things need to be taught to students as a form of Paideia and as a result of reordered love. Scholarship. The Ordo Amoris Via Truth, teaching truth. It seems to me that if we talk about the notion of integrating faith and learning, that the integration aspect only occurred actually at creation. So at creation we have the integration of faith and learning. But here are some questions that you may want to consider. How does your particular academic discipline participate in God's very good creation? What is it that's within your discipline that is a part of the very structure of creation? And where do the insights of non-Christian scholarship track well with the creational norms that we discern in Scripture? The fall seemed to me to be the disintegration of faith and learning. They were separated. And it's nothing as if, it's as if nothing took faith's place, but rather idolatrous faith is now integrated with learning. But here are some questions that you might want to consider. How has your discipline participated in the biblical rebellion we call the fall? How has your discipline been twisted by cultural idolatry? And what are the unhelpful signs within your discipline that are dehumanizing or contribute to a lack of creational flourishing? Redemption has to do with the reintegration of faith and learning. All things are reconciled to God through the blood of Jesus. Colossians chapter 1, verse 20, which we've already read. What are the healing paths that are evident within your discipline? Already. They're already there. What insights or correctives can Christian faith make to address the unhelpful developments within your discipline? And how does the mind of Christ renew your discipline in redemptive ways? I didn't come up with those questions on my own. They came from a fellow named Mike Wagaman. And that's the web address if you'd like to look at them. I have some more questions that if you would be interested in. I have some more questions about creation, fall, and redemption. Informing students to love things properly through scholarship, if you'd like to see them. As I conclude, I'd like to tell a story. And I'm not sure what time we're supposed to be finished. What time are we supposed to be finished in here? Does anybody know? 10:50? So we have an hour. We have plenty of time for questions. I had a professor in graduate school who was very helpful for me. He started out as a Roman Catholic. He became an atheist. He came back to the faith. Maybe I had something to do with it, I don't know. Into the Episcopal Church. From Episcopalianism, he converted back into Roman Catholicism. And he and I, on occasion, would get together for lunch. We became good buddies, largely due to faith, a common faith. We would go to a barbecue restaurant, and then we would go to the University of Dallas, have a cup of coffee, and sit and chat for quite some time. It seems that our conversations would always end up on the faith-reason relationship. But on one occasion, he said this. He said that the goal of education is not to produce scholars, but rather to produce saints. That hit me like a ton of bricks. I thought, well, maybe that's right. But then I got to thinking a little bit about what he had to say. It seems to me that it's not just simply producing saints, but saints through scholarship. And I think he needed to add that phrase in his statement to me on one of our lunches on one occasion. We'll call him Dr. Tim. That's all I want to say. Thank you very much. And I believe, according to the digital clock that we have, that I have in front of me, we have plenty of time for Q&A. So if you have some questions, I'd be happy to try to answer those questions. Who would like to go first? Anyone? Yes. It was a history of philosophy book by Samuel Enoch Stump on St. Augustine. That's what prompted me to write the book, actually. And I thought that there is a need for information, more information about Paideia and genuine happiness in God as a result. So that's what prompted me to write the book. Somebody else? Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be very political in my response to you and say both. And I really believe that. It's not just a political answer. I think that the students that we teach need to know about what's out there in terms of the isms. But they need to know about truth, goodness, and beauty at the same time. Is that what I hear you saying? Sufficient? What do you mean by the word sufficient? I'm sorry to have to ask a question about the question. Okay. Obviously, you could do that, but I'm thinking in terms of, I wish I had known more about the isms prior to college and not just wait until college to teach about the various isms like naturalism, for example. So I would do both. I really would. Yes, ma'am. Yes, sir. I'm sorry? What are some of the ways that it has been disintegrated? That faith and learning has been disintegrated? Well, I think the disintegration has occurred because we replace genuine biblical faith, our Christian worldview, or canonical Trinitarian theism, whatever you want to call it, with idolatrous faith. And it's as if nothing took Christian biblical faith's place, idolatrous faith did. And so there's a separation between biblical faith and genuine learning. So those need to be brought back together again through Christ as the great reconciler. Some practical ways that that has been broken? Well, let me respond by saying this. What about the notion of bucket list? What about the notion of retirement? Most of the students that I have, and this is at the college level, I admit, frequently speak about bucket lists, and they also look forward to retirement. So it seems to me that they're operating according to a different set of assumptions and presuppositions rather than biblical ones, idolatrous assumptions and presuppositions, in advocating the notion of a bucket list. Do we have to get everything in now? Probably not. Especially if we have a new heavens and a new earth and a resurrection body to come. Already, but not yet. So that's one thing. And the second thing has to do with retirement. Retirement, in my estimation, I think we can retire from a job, but not from a calling. And so when I hear people talk about retirement, they mean playing golf or going fishing or something like that constantly. And that lasts for maybe a week or two, the enjoyment of that. But retirement, it seems to me, says an awful lot about our attitudes toward work, toward gainful employment, toward doing what God has called us to do. So I hope that helps a little bit. But I think the high school students and college students both are held captive by the culture in which we live. That's really what I'm saying. And I'm trying to come up with a couple of examples there. Does that help a little bit? Ever? Oh, ma'am. I'm not sure how we keep it interesting other than to keep on telling it. And if they don't find it interesting, that's their problem. I think that we need to tell it in imaginative ways. The culture around us is good at, it seems to me, capturing our imagination. At least I know it's good at capturing my imagination. I walk through a room and one of the entertainment shows is on, and I want to watch it because they've captured my attention. And so it seems to me we need to capture the attention and the imagination of students with the biblical story. They need to understand the creation, fall, redemption story. It does become a little bit rote after a while. It can. But I think if you use illustrations like Humpty Dumpty to illustrate the fall, for example, or the Nike swoosh, then it's an appeal to popular culture, basically. But it does keep the storyline fresh. At least it has for me. And I remember one colleague of mine, not a teaching colleague, but a ministerial colleague, saying, "Oh, you're getting a lot of mileage out of that creation, fall, redemption story." And I said, "Well, yeah, I guess so. But it is the story, and it makes every story meaningful." So perhaps you can take an episode of your favorite television show and show that it follows a creation, fall, redemption path as well. That may be one way to keep it fresh and imaginative, possibly. Yes, sir. Scholarship is probably not too much different from what you actually do. It's teaching. It's teaching great books. It's teaching ideas. It's conveying to those who do not know them, perhaps in an interactive way or in an indoctrinational way, the ideas that have changed your own life. You want students to think the way you think. So I don't know if that answers your question as far as what scholarship is, but yes, that's how I would envision scholarship. And it's not that I want to set scholarship aside. I want students to be shaped and formed by what they hear, what they learn in the classroom and outside the classroom as well, by good teaching that occurs through us as their teachers, as their more mature learners, as their older learners. So I want people to be formed and shaped, possibly, hopefully, like that one student of mine who picked me up at the airport and said that his loves were on the way. Well, he said actually they were formed. I don't know if they were formed or not. He didn't show up to my final presentation that I made to this particular group. And he told me that he had car trouble. But they also grow up as well. And I see the things that are taught are probably not going to be remembered. At least if I and others are any example. We tend to forget most of what we've been taught. But we do remember the incarnational relationships that are powerful and profound in our lives. I had one student, this is an illustration of the incarnation, we invited him over to watch a Super Bowl. And he lifted his hands in praise of the Dallas Cowboys, this was a long time ago, when I think it was Emmitt Smith ran for a touchdown or something, and he left a mark in a low overhanging part of the ceiling. And he remembered that. He remembered that we had invited him over and he came to watch the Super Bowl at our house, and then he left a reminder of his presence with us. So incarnation, I think, is important. Scholarship is important as well, and there are examples of that as well. But I think that primarily students remember the investment that we make in lives. I was at a reunion recently, a Christian reunion, this past week in San Diego, California. And I put something on Facebook, and as a result, somebody who follows me on Facebook said, well, make sure that you tell these three people, there are three people who have invested in her life, hello for her, and that she appreciated them pouring their lives into hers while she was a student. Scholarship is imparting knowledge. I don't know if that answers your question completely or not, but it probably won't. But I think that people do remember the investment that we make in the lives of others most profoundly. Other questions? We have 11 minutes according to this clock right here. Yes, sir. Probably by modeling it. Probably by doing what you say. By exercising the ideas in your own life before them so that they can see it. Being a good mentor. Does that answer your question? That's how I would say those ideas are solidified. And how we can encourage scholarship in a practical kind of way. Anybody else? Well, then you have, according to this, 10 minutes to roam the halls and look at the books. Thank you for coming. Appreciate it.